From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Later in this episode, Leah Turner will join us to discuss how George Clooney is reclaiming art stolen by the Nazis in World War II. Well, on the big screen anyway. But first things first, we've got news to discuss. Joining me in the studio is Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque, who is courageously battling cedar allergies to be on this episode. Thank you for joining us, Melissa.
I'm going to do the best I can do.
You sound like Batman.
Yeah.
You do. Also with us is Observer staff writer Emily Duprang, who bakes a seriously delicious Christmas cookie. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Batman, because I understand that you have a story for us about Batman, or at least some gadgets worthy of the Dark Knight. So what's the scoop on that?
I do. Well, in the new issue, I talk about there are two developments in technology, police technology, that have recently taken place in Texas. One of them is super rad. It's expensive and rad, but I think it's going to be worth it.
Most rad things are expensive.
They are, aren't they?
Yep.
Or emotionally, if not financially. So police chases are one of the most expensive in life and in property. They're one of the most dangerous things that police officers do, and the biggest study ever done of police chases found that a quarter of them ended in some kind of property damage or injury. And when it was injury, one in five of those injuries happened to a bystander. So that's usually not somebody standing on the corner, but that's like somebody lawfully going at a green light, and then, you know, the suspect plows into them or the officer does. In fact, in 2012, the Austin's police reported 135 chases.
Mm-hmm.
22 of those ended in crashes. And one of them ended in a bystander fatality.
Oh, wow.
So the question is, how do you make them safer? Because police officers really resent being told not to chase bad guys.
Right.
But again, you're causing these people to – not causing. These people are fleeing dangerously. You can make things worse. So what APD has done is buy about a dozen of these front grill mounted GPS cannons. They work kind of like a t-shirt gun, and they're air cannons, and they shoot a GPS dart onto the back of the car that the officer is chasing.
Right.
And the officer just chills out.
Right.
And
go have a Mai Tai.
And
just
right.
Wait.
Has a Mai Tai and just beep, 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 tracks that guy.
Right.
Probably not with Mai Tais, maybe. I don't know.
Probably not.
But they can continue to track the suspect in real time and just meet up with him when he goes to his house. Because studies have shown that suspects will drop down to almost the speed limit as soon as they think that the chase has been discontinued. So it's a way to keep officers from – if it works, it's expensive. Each system costs about $5,000, and each of the darts costs about $250 to refurbish after you shoot it.
Okay.
But, you know, considering that it could save lives and property and lawsuits and everything, $5,000 is not actually that much. So if this pilot program goes well, APD wants to expand it to all their cars. So there's that.
Right.
Right. That's the Batman angle.
It's very Batman.
And then there's the way less rad and cutting edge, but still really relevant body cameras on police officers. Houston police, I've done a lot of reporting on it, have had a lot of citizen complaints and a lot of allegations of violence. And when the officer's word is against the citizens, you know, the officer's word is going to prevail.
Right.
And without proof that an officer acted inappropriately, there's very little that internal affairs is willing to do. So Houston is now about to get, by the end of the summer, they'll have 100 officers doing a pilot program where they're wearing body cameras all the time. All the time that they're on duty.
Right.
Right.
Let's get that straight.
Yeah. Just 24/7, we're just going to find out what kind of people they are. While
right.
they sleep, they'll have to mount it so that it stares at their face.
I mean,
reality show.
Right, right. HPD IRL. So anyway, that's awesome, because that's a $400,000 investment in resolving a whole lot of citizen complaints. And also, I mean, studies show that just knowing that you're being watched, knowing that you're being recorded, makes people act better.
Right.
So officers and citizens acting better. And, you know, if a citizen comes in and says, I want to complain about this, the police chief, you know, their justification for doing it is not to spy on officers, but so that they can show somebody the tape and say, see, I think you can agree that that's not what happened. The people go, oh, okay, I'm not going to complain, and then they don't have to do an investigation. So it's resolving it. So those are both technological advances that have the potential to make life safer for civilians and not just, you know, zany technology to improve life for cops.
Right on. And from there, we go to a story from Melissa about some politicians in Mexico on the lam, not just from the Mexican government, but from the U.S. government as well.
Yeah, we've had a real crop of Mexican politicians on the lam in the U.S., that have recently been indicted. And one of the most notable indictments is Tomás Yarrington, who's a former governor for Tamaulipas, which is the border state, one of the border states with Texas. And Governor Yarrington had a Senate proclamation in Texas. He was the mayor of Matamoros. He had a pretty close working relationship with George W. Bush. At one point, he was also being considered as a presidential nomination in Mexico. So he went from that to being a fugitive in two countries. And in early December, last week actually, the U.S. indicted him on 11 counts for drug trafficking, money laundering, and racketeering.
Whoa.
Yeah. And
so was he drug trafficking when he came to hang out with George W. Bush? Because that's a story.
Well, come down now.
Sorry now.
He was a governor from 1999 to 2005, and before that he was the mayor of Matamoros. So allegations started surfacing about him in different money laundering cases in February 2012. The U.S. authorities have been arresting some wealthy businessmen from Mexico who live in South Texas. And during the course of these investigations, his name kept popping up as somebody who was receiving massive amounts of money from different cartels and was allegedly investing that money in real estate and property in San Antonio and South Texas.
Uh-huh.
So we think that wasn't just birthday money or like...
No.
Okay. Just asking.
Yeah. And it kept popping. His name kept popping up. And in Mexico, they started investigating him as well. And but he wasn't under indictment, not until the first week of December when they finally announced the U.S. was indicting him. But what's unusual about Governor Yarrington is that he's sort of taking his case public on social media, unlike other indicted politicians.
Or people on the lam in general.
Or people right. who are wanted in two countries.
Right.
He's had a very vigorous profile on Twitter. He has his own website. He put together a press conference in Mexico City right after he was indicted with his Mexican and his U.S. lawyers, because now he's fighting cases in both countries.
Would that make him easier to find if he was holding a press conference?
Well,
like you could point at him?
The lawyer said, we don't know where he is. We know he's, you know, we just don't keep track of, you know, his itinerary. We can't tell you where he is. He was asked to leave the United States after the allegations surfaced about him in these different cases. So it's kind of ironic that they're now indicting him and looking for him when they asked him to leave, which mm-hmm. his lawyer who's from Houston, Joel Androphy, pointed out at the press conference. And he noticeably turned off the geolocator on his Twitter account, which is a good idea.
Hmm.
Although I'm sure the NSA could probably track him down if they wanted to.
Right, right.
So, he's been really making a spirited defense for himself online.
What is his defense?
Well, that these are protected witnesses. They'll say whatever it takes to get a lighter sentence. And that it's all based on false testimony, and that he's innocent, and he's going to prove his innocence.
So all the different cartels that are fighting against each other are all colluding to get him in trouble.
Well, yeah, he says he doesn't have anything to do with the cartels, that these are mm-hmm. just witnesses who got in trouble and are just trying to get lighter sentences mm-hmm. in both Mexico and the United States, that the witnesses on both countries are giving false testimony. But what's even crazier is that Yarrington isn't the only Mexican governor on the lam right now. Hmm. In Tyler, last year they picked up the former treasurer for the state of Coahuila, which is another border state with Mexico. And then the interim governor has also been indicted. So those two just got indicted recently as well. So it was a similar deal where they picked up Hector Javier Villarreal Hernandez, former Secretary of Finance for Coahuila. And the Tyler police picked him up. He was in a Mercedes SUV, and they said he didn't have a front license plate. So they pulled him over, and they searched his car, and they found $67,000 and a rifle, and his wife and kids were in there and another man. So they ended up putting he and his wife in jail. But then, oddly enough, they transferred him over to Homeland Security and they let him go.
What?
Because he said that they had valid visas, so there was no reason to keep them. So, yeah, odd. But anyway, now they've been indicted, so they're also, I would imagine, not in Texas anymore.
Right. That's what they want you to think.
Yeah, right. And they are not on social media either.
Oh, okay.
Unlike Governor Yarrington, who is on Twitter.
How many Mexican governors are there? Like, what's our rate at this point of indicted Mexican governors?
Well, another one was just sentenced from Quintana Roo in New York, I think last month, and we've got another one who's in exile, self-imposed exile in Spain. So there's quite a few right now, and a lot of them seem to come to Texas or have investments in Texas. So we have an interesting connection with all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for sharing those stories, guys.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. In our December issue, Melissa Del Bosque told the story of Rosa Moreno, a factory worker who lost her hands making television parts. Melissa, tell us a little bit more about this story.
Sure. I first heard about Rosa through a longtime documentary photographer here in Austin named Alan Pogue.
Alan Pogue?
Yeah, and he's been a longtime photographer for The Observer, done a lot of really amazing things over the years. And he told me about Rosa's predicament, where in 2011 she was working in a factory that made the backs of flat-screen televisions for LG. And she was working a 200-ton hydraulic press, and it malfunctioned and fell on top of her hands and basically smashed her hands into the back of the metal piece. And she was driven to a hospital. They didn't provide an ambulance or anything like that. They actually tried to take care of it at the infirmary at the factory, because in Mexico they don't like to report the accidents to the government, because then that means that the companies have to pay more money into the risk pool for coverage.
So you avoid hospitals.
So they avoid hospitals if they can. So they were trying to treat her in the infirmary, and you know, the workers were like, "Are you crazy?"
Were her hands severed at that point? Were they just crushed?
They were crushed mm-hmm. onto the metal piece.
Right.
So one of the workers was like, "You know what? I'm just going to drive her myself." So they drove her to the hospital, and they had to amputate her hands. And she's got six kids. She actually has eight children, but two of her kids are in their 20s and are married and have moved out. So she's got six kids that she cares for, and then her husband's in jail. So she's the sole provider for her kids. And so the whole story is sort of based around Rosa, but really Rosa is an example of just how much things have deteriorated even further for workers in the maquiladoras. In Mexico. And maquiladoras, if you don't know, they're factories, usually foreign-owned. It's like a free trade zone along the northern border with the United States. And there's companies there from all over the world. And, you know, they can import, export, very, very, very low taxes. And really, Mexico has advertised itself as this place where they will provide highly skilled, very, very low-wage labor, and that's been their model for some time, and it just hasn't benefited the communities. In fact, it's really been a huge disadvantage. And it's been 20 years now since NAFTA was signed and ratified in 94, and the whole deal with the North American Free Trade Agreement was that, you know, they said they were going to improve workers' conditions and raise their wages. And
it was supposed to combat unemployment in Mexico while giving us cheap TVs, right?
Right, exactly. We get the cheap imported goods and, you know, everybody would be happy.
Not so much.
Kumbaya, all that. Yeah, and but in fact, you know, that wasn't the case. And in fact, it's actually gotten worse because their wages haven't increased at all, really, since NAFTA, not much at all. And the,
so it's 20 years without the wages increasing?
Yeah, very incrementally, mm-hmm. not at all with inflation and then the cost of living. And they always have, you know, people who are real big NAFTA supporters like to make people think that the cost of living is so much cheaper in Mexico, mm-hmm. and it's really not. I mean, it's about the same as it is in the U.S.
Really?
In some cases, more expensive. So, you know, especially with Rosa's, what happened to her, she was really, really struggling, and there was no grievance process for her after the accident. They said, you know, we're not responsible. You were tired, you know. They offered her a settlement of about $4,000 for the loss of her hands, you know, which is just ridiculous.
And I thought it was interesting that this is an incredible story, and for the press to operate correctly, a button has to be pressed with each hand, so to prevent this. So the fact that the press came down on both her hands means the press definitely malfunctioned. This wasn't something that she could have made a terrible mistake.
Right, and even though they tried to say it was worker error, I thought it interesting in the statement that LG gave me, and you know, the LG said, well, this had nothing to do with us. This was just one of our vendors. It happened in their factory. It's very unfortunate. And they did say in their statement that apparently machine malfunction. So I thought that was interesting that LGE actually admitted publicly that it looked like, you know, obviously mm-hmm. the machine had malfunctioned, even though I don't think HD has ever admitted that.
HD is the company that
the
she
HD Electronics,
for
yeah, was okay. the company that she was working for, which is another Korean company. So they work for incredibly low wages. She made $100 a week, $400 a month. And so they offered her a settlement of $4,000, and she said, no, I'm not going to take that. You know, it's just unacceptable. There's no way I can keep taking care of my family. So so I kind of followed her through the process of going to different attorneys in Mexico trying to get she was trying to get one of them to represent her for a better settlement, and none of them would. And one even suggested to her that she go out and, like, beg for money on the bridge, mm-hmm. which is, like, the worst, kind of the low point. So Ed Kruger, who's a retired minister, lives in the Rio Grande Valley, has a nonprofit group called Comité de Apoyo, Committee of Help. And what they do is they work in the factories with factory workers in Mexico, educating them about labor laws and about their rights. And one of his, one of the women that he works with, who also works in the maquiladoras, Rosa got so desperate that she went on television and said, look, this is what's going on. This is unacceptable, because it was kind of like her last attempt at getting some sort of justice.
Her last hope.
It seemed like there wasn't really anywhere else for her to turn, except for, like, these extreme things. Like,
yeah.
Can I get on television?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much her last hope. And so then Paulina Hernandez, who works with Ed, saw her on TV and then found her, you know, figured out where she lived and went to talk to her. And so they have been working with Rosa now for, gosh, a couple of years, I think, trying to get her help. And now she has a U.S. lawyer, and they have a lawsuit with LG. It's still in the process. Not sure what's going to happen with that lawsuit. And so, yeah, so she's just waiting to see what happens. She may be coming here to the U.S. and getting a visa to for her court hearing. And they're trying to get maybe a wealthy donor to get her some prosthetic hands.
So what's life like for her now that she's waiting?
Well, it's really tough. I mean, when I met with her in early October, she was about ready to lose her house, you know, because she couldn't make the payments anymore. And she's, I mean, how can she work? She doesn't have any hands, right. You know? So she was trying to negotiate with them to get like a, I guess she'd already negotiated with them once and got a lower payment, but she was still really struggling. So yeah, she's just waiting and hoping, and she's very religious. She's been praying a lot. It's just a very, really symbolic, I think, what's happened to her of just the general deterioration of workers' rights, and that they just have no recourse if something like that happens. And then I met with a bunch of other workers, too, who had various injuries that were work-related. They said that the companies didn't want to acknowledge as being work-related, and that they felt like the unions are all co-opted, basically, most of them. So they couldn't get any help from the unions and the politicians that are on the side of the companies. And so they've just got everything stacked against them, you know. And then NAFTA doesn't really help either, because it has this sort of facade of some sort of grievance process, but it doesn't really exist or work. So, yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that story with us.
Sure, yeah.
You can read this story on TexasObserver.org, where it goes by the name We Are Disposable. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Joining us in the studio is Leah Cherner, who has a story with just about everything you'd want in it, including stolen artwork, stolen by Nazis, actually, a Dallas oil man, and George Clooney. Leah, tell us about The Monuments Men.
Well, The Monuments Men is the title of a film that is being released by Sony Pictures, and it stars George Clooney, Matt Damon, John Goodman, Cate Blanchett, and Bill Murray. So it's a huge ensemble cast, directed by Clooney, and supposed to be released in December, but it's been pushed back to February.
So there's still time.
There's still time, and nobody has seen it. They released a few different trailers. So the story is about this group of soldiers, some of whom were drafted and some of whom volunteered, who were conservators and curators from American art museums and also museums in the UK and Canada. They were the Western Allied Efforts MFAA section, the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives group, also known as the Monuments Men. There are also women in the Monuments Men group, however. So they were charged with protecting monuments and buildings and churches in Europe from war damage. But as they got there, they discovered the Germans were looting movable artworks and doing crazy things, hiding them in caves and salt mines and booby-trapping them with dynamite so that if Hitler couldn't have them, nobody could. About a week after the Sony announced that the film was going to be postponed, a German news magazine broke the story of a massive trove of art that was secretly stashed in the Munich apartment of a Nazi art dealer's son, who was not even known to exist. He was kind of off the grid at this point, selling these artworks that he was secretly hiding in his apartment. There was about $1.3 billion worth of art in his apartment.
Wow.
Sort of just like, sitting.
Just hanging out.
In unframed by in a bunch of, just pile of moldy trash and stuff like that. It was kind of like
I hope he doesn't have cats.
Yeah. Well, there were about 1,500 works, and there was Picasso's and Matisse's and Chagall's. And, you know, it was just really shocking. And the really amazing thing is that Germany has known about it for 2 years. They caught this guy going across the border with a huge amount of cash on him. And so then the Germans customs raided his apartment and found out that he had all this art. But that was 2 years ago. And since then, they've been allegedly just inventorying the stuff. But really, like, when the story came out, it was apparently leaked because it was a huge problem. Huge PR blunder, and now Germany is going to have to deal with all of these restitution cases that are going to be brought to the state by Holocaust survivors' ancestors, because a lot of this art was stolen from the private collections of Jewish families.
Sure. So what's the Texas connection for the Monuments Men?
Well, the Texas connection is Robert Edsel, who is a Dallas-based oil man turned author. He grew up in Dallas.
It's an interesting combination.
Yes. He went to St. Mark's in Dallas and then SMU. He majored in finance, and then he went into the oil and gas exploration business with his brother, Jim Edsel, and they started a company called Gemini Exploration, which is a pun on Jim and I. And they were one of the companies that pioneered horizontal drilling, which is kind of a, as I understand, kind of a precursor to fracking. He made a ton of money and cashed out and retired in 1995. And he sold his business for $35 million and went on a long vacation to Italy with his family.
Good for him.
And they bought a house in Florence. And then Edsel has a lot of time on his hands and becomes really interested in the cultural riches of Florence and starts learning about art history. And he hires a art historian to take him around and sort of be a private tutor about Renaissance art in Florence. He just becomes more and more engrossed in this field of art history, and then he kind of starts to wonder, well, how did all this artwork survive and all these great monuments and buildings and churches survive World War II? And his art historian friend recommended that he read Lynn Nicholas's book, The Rape of Europa, which was a 1994 I think it won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. And it's a really interesting book, very different from the one that Edsel wrote, Monuments Men, which is what this film is based on. And there's a bunch of kind of complicated backbiting between the two sides of this. There's the film, The Rape, or there was the book, The Rape of Europa, came out, and Edsel optioned the book for the movie rights. And while he was doing that, while he had the rights to the movie, he was writing his own book and shopping that around as a feature film. And he also put up the money to finish, he put up about $250,000 to finish the documentary version of The Rape of Europa, which was produced by Actual Films. And in exchange for the finishing funds for the film, which is about 25% of their budget, he got the full distribution rights and a producer credit and access to all of their research, which he used to write the Monuments Men book. So he's a controversial guy in this scholarly field because he's not really a scholar. He sort of just bought this information and has been writing from it, and I think he has had help writing it. Mm-hmm. But you know, at the same time, he's an advocate for cultural preservation, and he founded a nonprofit organization called the Monuments Men Foundation that promotes awareness about the activities of the Monuments Men and about the problem of cultural preservation and lost art.
Right on. Well, thanks for stopping by and talking to us about the Monuments Men.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.